From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, August 25th, 2017. And on this day, does the Pine Tree Development Zone program create jobs in Maine? A new report says it's hard to even know. And we'll meet a very busy taxidermist in York County. That's all ahead in just a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
Does Maine's Pine Tree Development Zone program create jobs? Well, a new analysis from the legislature's watchdog agency says the program doesn't have the data collection and accountability to even assess its true capacity to do so. The agency is recommending a major overhaul, but as Steve Missler reports, some lawmakers think it's time to scrap the 13-year-old program, which costs the taxpayers $12 million a year.
The Pine Tree Development Zone program was created by Democratic Governor John Baldacci in 2003 and touted as a way to attract business and create jobs in economically depressed areas. But according to a report from the Office of Program Evaluation and Government Accountability, or OPEGA, the program isn't designed to achieve that goal, and its value as a job creation tool is highly suspect. OPEGA senior analyst Jennifer Henderson presented the findings to the legislature's Government Oversight Committee on Wednesday.
We don't know, we can't report today what it has actually achieved in terms of jobs.
Right.
But we can tell you unequivocally that the design does not guarantee that a vast number of jobs will be created.
The Pine Tree Zone program provides qualifying businesses with an array of tax benefits, including income tax credits and sales tax exemptions for the purchase of business equipment. In exchange, the businesses agree to create jobs and pay higher wages. But under the current version of the program, a qualifying business can immediately receive Pine Tree Zone benefits, but won't have to create a single job until 2 years later. And even then, says Henderson, the hiring requirement is minimal.
And so you could have a business hiring just one new employee with a fairly significant amount of benefits.
The Department of Economic and Community Development, one of the agencies that administer the program, does collect job creation statistics from businesses in Pine Tree, but the numbers are self-reported. OPEGA Director Beth Ashcroft says that's a problem.
We think there's significant risk that using just those numbers will either overstate or understate what the actual program outcomes are here.
In fact, OPEGA found other data deficiencies as well. Pine Tree provides sales tax exemptions to businesses for purchases, but there's no accounting of whether those purchases are for business purposes. And it's possible that the program's income tax credit could exceed a business's actual tax liability. OPEGA also found that the original purpose of the program, to spur job and business growth in economically depressed areas, was subverted when lawmakers changed the law to allow the entire state, including much more prosperous areas, to participate in Pine Tree. Finally, lawmakers have also created carve-outs that allow businesses in some areas to provide a lesser job benefit to employees. That happened 2 years ago when the legislature allowed call centers in Aroostook and Washington counties to qualify for Pine Tree, but to skirt a requirement that they pay workers more than the county's medium income.
Yes, there is very little accountability.
Senator Bill Diamond is a Democrat from Windham who sits on the Government Oversight Committee. He says it's time to ditch Pine Tree and find a new economic development strategy.
This fish is way too big to fry. We have to start over because there's so many complications. It's so complex. It's gotten to a point where it really has totally lost the profile and the purpose that it had originally. I think that there's a good reason to have something, and I think the committee recognizes that.
And fellow committee member Tom Saviello, a Republican state senator from Wilton, says he supported the program in 2003 because the state needed a business attraction tool.
But listening to this, it sounds like to me that it's time has come and gone. Unless we want to recommend doing major overhaul work to it.
But the LePage administration may not agree. In his written response to the OPEGA report, DECD Commissioner George Gervais said lawmakers should, quote, look past the process and bureaucratic minutia, end quote, and ask businesses directly whether the Pine Tree program is working. The OPEGA report did not evaluate whether Pine Tree has actually attracted investment or whether the program is even set up to measure it. But the business community will get the chance to have their say when the Oversight Committee holds a public hearing on the report in mid-September. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
The future of the First Atlantic Marine National Monument will likely be decided in court. A lawsuit that challenges the designation of the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument is on hold as fishermen's groups wait to hear specific recommendations from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Zinke announced this week he would not recommend eliminating any national monuments, but he would propose some changes. And as Patty White reports, supporters of the Marine Monument off Cape Cod say if any changes go through, they will mount a legal challenge.
The creation of the 5,000-square-mile monument on the edge of Georgia's Bank this past September closed the area to commercial fishing. Soon after, five fishing organizations across New England filed a lawsuit. The attorney who represents them, Jonathan Wood of the Pacific Legal Foundation, says the suit was put on hold while the monuments were under review.
It remains on hold, and I suppose until we know what the president is going to do, it will stay on hold.
The lawsuit challenges the authority that President Obama used when he created the monument. Wood says federal law only allows presidents to designate monuments on land owned or controlled by the government.
And the ocean, 100 miles from the United States, is obviously not land. I mean, I think anyone can get that. But it's also not owned or controlled by the federal government.
Wood says the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument designation should be revoked. And though Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke announced this week he would not recommend any monument be eliminated, Wood is hopeful that President Trump will.
He could still decide to revoke the monument, to change the boundaries substantially, or to reduce the fishing restrictions.
But supporters of the monument, like Peter Shelley of the Conservation Law Foundation, oppose any changes.
It's essentially a revocation of the purpose of the monument, and all you would have there is essentially another paper park.
Shelley says former President Obama had already made compromises in response to fishermen's concerns when he designated the monument. He significantly reduced its size and allowed crab and lobster fishermen with existing permits to continue operations for 7 years. Dr. Peter Oster, a senior research scientist at the Mystic Aquarium in Connecticut, says the monument carves out just 1.5% of the total area available for exploitation off the east coast of the U.S.
This would be the only place that's protected in perpetuity from all forms of commercial extractive activity.
A place that Oster says should be protected because it's so unique.
The canyons are deeper than the Grand Canyon and mountains, the Seamounts part of the monument. The mountains rise are taller than anything east of the Rockies.
Those canyons and submarine mountains are home to a number of ecological zones and creatures, including more than 50 species of deep-sea coral. Peter Shelley says if President Trump weakens protections, the Conservation Law Foundation will take the issue to court, a place that will likely determine the final outcome of this monument. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
Our next installment of Once Upon a Job takes us into a world of glass eyes, antlers, and hides. Taxidermy had its heyday during the Victorian era when animals were hunted and made into parlor ornaments. Changing sensibilities, among other factors, led the profession into decline during the 20th century. But as Jennifer Mitchell reports, the craft is experiencing something of a renaissance.
So we got all kinds of stuff in here.
Taxidermist Paul Reynolds is rooting through a large chest freezer at his studio in Dayton. The freezer is filled to the top with frosty hides, heads, and carcasses of varying description, each one a promised project for a client who will wait months for the finished product.
A turkey fan and beard that I have to do for a customer. I've got a black bear here, black bear skull for a European mount. We've got in here a little woodcock.
Business is good, but it hasn't always been so. One of the biggest factors, says Reynolds, is that taxidermy has become trendy in urban settings. In nouveau chop houses, meaderies, and craft brew pubs, appealing to millennials in a way that it just didn't to their parents. And he says it's not as hard as it once was to get into the profession.
I think a big problem with taxidermy is that the old guard, the old timers, I'm talking guys, and I'm 52 and I was a young man, they just didn't want to pass on the knowledge. And they were very reluctant to tell people how they do things for fear of losing business.
Reynolds says as a youth, he approached a master taxidermist in the area, one of the best bird mounters in the country, who refused to share his knowledge. So he signed up for a correspondence course advertised in the back of a hunting magazine. After a lot of trial and error, he started to get the hang of it. Now, 40 years on, his freezers are full and the orders keep coming.
I've got 7 freezers full of projects right now. If a person walks in the door, I'm back about a year and a half. With work, and that's trying to get stuff done every day.
As Reynolds tries to find an assistant to help with the backlog of orders, he's also willing to share the skills of the trade with others.
So this is going to be, again, coastal looking. You know, we're going to have the barnacles. I'll probably put
today,
some...
Reynolds is teaching Tammy Cruciati how to mount a sea duck onto a shore habitat.
Now, at this point, I'm just going to very roughly screw it together, and then we're going to foam it together.
It always seems like a waste. You just throw away the part that, like the skin or the hides or whatnot. Now I can put them to use and their memories.
Cruciati is an avid hunter and angler who works in hospital radiology by day. But when she and her husband came into Reynolds' shop to have a moose mounted, Cruciati found what she says might be her next career.
I started asking questions because I started looking at his stuff. I do painting at home and I saw he had some stuff out. I think he might have been painting duck bills the day I came in. I became very interested, and he offered, said he was very busy, asked if either of us were willing to learn taxidermy. I was like, yeah, I'd love to. And so I started off, I think, the very next week.
That was about 9 months ago. And since then, Cruciati has been learning the basics of the business, from creating realistic-looking habitats and perfecting the right form, draping the skin and moving it into place, how to hide little mistakes, add eyes, details, and place feathers one by one. Taxidermy comes from 2 Greek words, taxis, meaning arrangement, and derma, meaning skin. So that stuffed deer you might see in a sporting goods store, there's nothing but a deer-shaped form under there, which might be sculpted from styrofoam, or if it's an older mount, might be stuffed with excelsior and padding. The skins themselves are sent away to be custom tanned with the hair on. Cruciati has been working on her own project at home, a duck, but Reynolds says even if he's not around to answer a question she might have, Cruciati can simply go online.
Social media, and you've got YouTube, and there's so many people that put out videos how to do stuff. None of that was available when I was started. I guess it's more proper to share information than it is to hold back now.
The entrance of women like Cruciati into the taxidermy culture is another factor that's helping the profession to rebound, as is the rise of so-called rogue taxidermy. That's a mixed media art form that can incorporate real and artificial taxidermy components. And for those who want to become a taxidermist in Maine, all the state requires is a license application and a $50 fee. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine, Friday, August 25th, 2017. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team, I'm Nora Flaherty.